We begin this evening, though, with the common travel area. Over the last 2 years, the regulation of the movement of goods has dominated the Brexit negotiations. But the movement of people between Britain and Ireland could, of course, also prove complicated. Our reciprocal agreement of free movement rights includes the right to work, settle, claim benefits and even vote, and has lasted for the better part of 100 years. Partly, that's because our immigration policies have always been strongly aligned. But that could change now that Britain is leaving the EU and Ireland is staying put. This isn't the first time this unusual arrangement has hit a stumbling block. I'm joined by two guests who have been looking into the history of the Common Travel Area, our Open Borders Agreement with our nearest neighbour. Pearse McHenry is in our Cork studio. He's a lecturer in geography at University College Cork. And with me here in Dublin is Gavin Barrett, a professor of the Sutherland School of Law in University College Dublin. You're both very welcome indeed to the programme. Gavin, take us back to the Anglo-Irish Treaty, 1921, signed, sealed, not quite delivered in December of 1921, but finally delivered then in January of 1922. It doesn't say much about matters of migration and settlement. Was it assumed that reciprocal immigration and settlement would simply continue in the two jurisdictions?
To a certain extent, I think it was. Obviously, pre-1922, free movement had never been in question because it was the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland as such. So travel between Ireland and what's now Ireland and the UK was simply travel within the UK. But post-signature of the treaty, the issue of common travel actually didn't actually feature in the treaty, remarkably. But afterwards, UK officials realised the scale of the task that would have been confronting them in patrolling a 500-kilometre-long border. So they made an offer to Irish officials that they would dispense with immigration controls, passports and visas, if you like, and so on and so forth, if Ireland enforced British immigration rules. And that was that arrangement, which was seized upon with alacrity by Irish officials who were anxious, as we know from letters of the time, to control aliens and, quote, keep Bolshevists at bay, was accepted with alacrity and confirmed in a letter February 1923.
I would imagine that the word immigration was almost not in the Irish lexicon back in the early 1920s.
No, that's very true. And to a certain extent, I think this was an offer that was too good to refuse because, there would have been very, very little immigration into Ireland in Ireland at that time. So, making concessions in terms of enforcing British immigration rules, it was really hardly a concession at all.
Pearse, it's worn fairly well, despite the fact that there would have been a number of potential crises. One would have been the economic war in the 1930s, then neutrality in the 1940s, and I suppose finally the declaration of a republic 70 years ago in 1949. But it's worn well.
It's worn extraordinarily well, really, and in fact it's proved to be very resilient, perhaps partly in fact in due to the fact it's not actually embodied in a treaty, a formal international treaty, but certainly, I mean, you mentioned the Declaration of a Republic, and there were those on the British side who tended to feel after them, well, if the Irish want to be that independent, let them go off and we'll treat them as an entirely foreign country. But as it happens, pragmatic considerations overruled that on their side. They could see the benefits. After all, the British economy was expanding then. The National Health Service had just come in. They were building their motorways. So it suited them very well to have this nearby source of English-speaking cheap labour on their doorstep, a culture that was familiar to them. And in a sense, it suited the Irish as well too. So we had the benefits of being an independent country, but managed to hold on to this privileged relationship with our former rulers. And it was, in a sense, the best of the both worlds for Ireland, as long as immigration did not loom large in our own internal policy considerations, and it didn't, as Gavin has already said, at that time.
Yeah, at that time, except now that 17% of the population of Ireland is immigrant. Who knows what's going to happen after the European Union, after the vacation of the European Union by Britain. But tell us a little bit more, Pearse, about the hiccup during what we call the emergency, what they called apparently World War II.
Well, there was a concern at that point that there could be undesirables arriving into the United Kingdom via the back door of Northern Ireland. And it's very interesting that there are echoes of some current debates in that matter, because what they actually did was they introduced the necessity to have permits, but it was imposed between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, the very thing which they're now saying they can't do. And there's an interesting reply to a parliamentary question put in 1948 in the House of Commons, where the Under Secretary for the Home Office, in answer to a question from a unionist MP, says at one time, although I do not know if this was confirmed, the commander in Northern Ireland thought he could not have an effective control of the land border except with four divisions. Now, you know, one must make allowances for changes in technology and so on, but the point that was being made there really was that the border was more or less unsealable. And then these permits actually remained in place until 1952. And the reason for that was that the British wanted a very firm assurance that Irish immigration policy would continue to be aligned with British immigration policy. I would argue, in fact, that it really meant that we would effectively follow British immigration policy. And once those guarantees were in place from the Irish side, then the arrangement continued and the travel permit requirement was lifted.
And, Gavin, do you reckon that the fact that this arrangement did survive World War II, it was indicative of the fact that it was quite robust?
Yes, there's no doubt it has been quite robust. I mean, it's been there since the foundation of the state. It survived the Irish-UK Economic War, World War II, the Declaration of a Republic, entry to the European Union, and the creation of the Schengen Zone. So it is durable, and I think probably its informality helped it to be durable, if you like, that what we ended up with from 1952 onwards was an administrative arrangement rather than a legally binding arrangement. And that actually suited both sides, because it didn't particularly suit, an Ireland, if you like, intoxicated to a certain extent upon nationalist rhetoric, if you like, to admit that it was allowing large numbers of its young people to go over and emigrate and work in Britain. And it suited as well the United Kingdom, the arrangement as well, because they were giving very favourable arrangements in terms of immigration to Irish citizens when they weren't willing to offer at times the same arrangements to Commonwealth citizens.
OK, we'll come back to 1952 and what actually happened in 1952 in just a few moments. But Piarish, just to take you up on something you were talking about there earlier, and that was the fact that Northern Ireland travellers faced checks if they wished to enter Britain. This was something, obviously, that unionists were not very pleased about, but of course they didn't have the balance of power at that stage. So did anybody care in Britain?
No, they took a pretty tough line, really. The unionists raised it on a regular basis in the House of Commons, and of course they were unhappy with it, because clearly it stated what we know to be the case, that Northern Ireland was treated differently from the rest of the United Kingdom, which rather flew in the face of the normal kind of doctrine that Belfast is the same as Finchley. Was that what Mrs. Thatcher used to say? So in effect, it did mean it was being treated differently. But as I say, the British took the line that as long as they didn't have an absolute assurance that the Southern government was following the same immigration policies as themselves, they did have an ongoing concern with this leaky land border. And that's really the issue which still faces us today in certain respects.
Gavin, what happened then in 1952, and why did anything have to happen then?
Well, what happened was that from December 1946, Ireland permitted aliens to enter freely from Britain, and from the end of December 1947, the UK actually dropped its requirement of a permit when travelling between the island of Ireland and Great Britain, but they didn't drop immigration controls, and that, as Piarish has mentioned, was something that very much annoyed Northern Unionists. So the UK government view was that they would only be prepared to abolish such controls if the Republic would once again join them in working a common system for the control of aliens, and to crucially to follow a similar immigration policy, which, as Piarish correctly indicated, involved essentially us following UK immigration rules. So an administrative arrangement was then reached between Ireland and the United Kingdom, and the terms of that arrangement were quite interesting. The Irish authorities agreed to give the Home Office, for example, information about all aliens who entered or left Ireland, and it agreed to refuse leave to land to persons in transit to the UK if they hadn't permission to actually enter the United Kingdom, and indeed to readmit aliens who were refused access to the United Kingdom. So once Ireland was prepared to accept all of that, then essentially the arrangement went ahead. The British were happy to get rid of immigration controls, and it was interesting. Irish officials were quite anxious. It was never publicised. It was never never made public. The terms of it were not made aware to either the Irish or English public at the time. And I think that its status as an administrative arrangement very much helped that and avoided giving it any embarrassing publicity. And interestingly enough, Frank Aiken, the Irish Minister for Foreign Affairs at the time, gave an astonishingly evasive reply to a Doyle question on whether there had been consultation on the abolition of controls. And instead of saying yes, that there had been, that there had been more than that in agreement, and then being forced to explain what the terms of it were, he simply said that the Irish government had been informed, but that its attitude was that the abolition of a British control was a matter for the British themselves.
And could I just add to that absolutely succinct point there made by Gavin, a dramatic example of that in a sense is that as recently as the 1980s, when I was myself a civil servant in a different government department, the Home Office used to circulate a famous, we called it the Black Book, which was actually the monthly updated index of persons forbidden entry to the UK. It was issued by the British authorities, but that was circulated to all Irish embassies and missions. And if a person on that list applied to come to Ireland, without even indication they intended to visit the UK as well, the automatic practice was to refuse them. So we simply followed the British line without any question. And the other point I would like to make is that in terms of the difference between administrative and legislative arrangements, I think it's been a long-standing tradition in the Department of Justice that they have preferred to operate by administrative fiat rather than legislation, because that means they're less likely to be held up to questioning via the process of Doyle questions and so on. It has suited the minister of the day to have a wide degree of discretion in immigration matters generally, and that remains the case in certain respects today.
And Piers, then in the 70s and 80s, during the troubles with the passage of amendments and with the passage of various prevention of terrorism Max amendments to that legislation or whatever, how did that affect the common travel area?
Well, you've just mentioned something there which I think, and again I defer to Gavin on this one, but the PTA does represent in effect a challenge to the CTA, because it did give the power for people to be prevented from entering, not only coming from Northern Ireland through Britain, but also they could be prevented from coming from the Republic to any part of the United Kingdom. So the PTA in effect transcended the normal provisions of the CTA, and there are some questions to be asked there about the extent to which that might be in certain situations used or abused to get around the normal terms and conditions of the CTA. But I think Gavin would have a more precise answer on that one.
Gavin?
Well, actually, just 2 points on what Piers has had to say there. The point about informality, I think, is a very telling one indeed. And that is that, you know, there's been a constant preference in the history of the common travel area for administrative cooperation over laws. When it came to laws, statutory instruments over statutes and obscure statutes over clear ones, with the result that you had as much secrecy and flexibility as possible in the organisation of this. And, of course, Piers is absolutely right concerning the PTA. And that emphasises another point, actually, about the common travel area, and that is its fragility in a number of respects, both to legislation and to other aspects as well. So, for instance, one point that we've all experienced in recent times is that when you travel from the United Kingdom to Ireland through Dublin Airport, you are asked for your passport. I travelled back the other day from Newcastle Airport myself. My passport was demanded of me. At the same time, you can travel north and south of the border. You can travel on the ferries very frequently without producing your passport. But it is a fragile construct indeed, and it is vulnerable to legislative interventions and indeed interventions by private parties like Ryanair, for instance.
Do we need to distinguish between the right of travel and, say, the right of residency and the right to benefits and the right to vote?
Well, nobody is questioning those. And in fact, you know, it has been one of the great success stories that there's an extraordinary degree of reciprocity and rights accorded to the Irish in Britain and the British in Ireland. They too can vote, of course, in Irish elections, with the exception of the presidential election, because they don't have the equivalent over there. It's based very much on the idea of reciprocity.
So if we could elect the Queen, we would be entitled to a vote on the monarchical election in Britain, yeah? Gavin, the entry then into the European Union, or the EEC as it was then in 1973, the Schengen Common Travel Area, did that exist before we both joined on the 1st of January 1973? Did that come later? And how did that affect, or might that have affected the common travel area?
Well, our entry into the European Union had a number of effects. One of them was that it involved us, I suppose, three different effects. One of the initial entry was a point, and then I suppose the Schengen agreement was another crucial element then, and the single market in between the two of them. So if I can just deal with those three elements. The first of them, actually, the entry into the European communities in 1973, meant that as part and parcel of that, we entered a customs union with all of the other member states. And in actual fact, that put an end then to the requirement of customs controls to control tariffs, taxes between the countries. But it didn't put an end to them to control other aspects like agricultural checks or plant health checks or consumer protection or that kind of thing. That remained until, if you like, the second step, which was the coming into force of the single European market at the beginning of 1993. From that point onwards, customs controls could be done away with. And there are actually three sets of controls that have been possible, if you like, along the border with Northern Ireland. Customs controls, security controls, British Army checkpoints, if you like, and Garda checkpoints and so on and so forth, and then passport controls. We never had passport controls because of the common travel area. We had customs controls until 1993. Then, if you like, the single European market sweeps them away. And then the security controls could finally be done away with then as a result of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. Now, as regards the Schengen area, which was, of course, the border-busting agreement that the other member states agreed to, you know, that was always, I suppose, envisaged, if you like, by European Union, but it was something that couldn't happen, ironically, within the European Union because the British opposed it so resolutely. So what happened was you had an intergovernmental treaty agreed between other states in 1985, then again in 1990, and it entered into force in 1995. And that was integrated into the European Union treaties with the coming into force of the Treaty of Amsterdam in 1999. But the British didn't want it. And it's a logical impossibility, if you think about it, to be part of two common travel areas at the same time, unless the entire membership of each common travel area is prepared to allow all members of the other common travel area into their common travel area. The British are saying they simply didn't want to be in a common travel area with the other European states. So Ireland then had a choice. Do we join Schengen or do we stay in the common travel area with the United Kingdom? And a reputed 70% of all of the traffic leaving Ireland was either going to the United Kingdom or going through the United Kingdom at the time. So really, from a practical point of view, the practical arguments militated strongly in favour of remaining within the common travel area. And so as a result of that, a kind of PS to the treaty, a protocol to the treaty, in fact, three of them were actually negotiated facilitating that and basically allowing Ireland to continue on with the common travel area with Britain. And incidentally, that was actually the first treaty reference ever made to the common travel area, remarkably. And it's not actually in a treaty between Ireland and the UK at all, but a European Union treaty. Mm. So that was made. That facilitated it, if you like, the continuation of the common travel area. Ireland actually was reluctant. The British entered into that because they wanted to maintain border controls. We simply entered into that arrangement because we wanted to maintain the common travel area. And we actually attached a declaration at Amsterdam indicating that we'd enter into anything, if you like, any free movement measures that were compatible with maintaining the common travel area. But I'm afraid we weren't as good as our word in that regard. And we've taken advantage, if you like, of the arrangements, our opt-out with an opt-in, if you like, concerning Schengen. We've taken advantage of that just to opt into what we want to. And it has taken on a bit of a life of its own, so that when the British expanded that protocol with the Treaty of Lisbon in 2007 to justice and home affairs cooperation generally, we actually went with them, so that our opt-out, merely out of free movement, things became a much bigger opt-out.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Gavin Barrett and Piarsh McHenry, for joining us and talking to us about the history of the common travel area and some of the complexities, perhaps, that might arise from Britain's exit from the European Union.